You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of October 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Chris Lord. On today's show, Turkey convicts a Wall Street Journal reporter for promoting terrorism through her work, apparently. Well, we ask where the state's war on the free press is leading. My guests, Somnath Batabayel and Jonathan Fenby, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories. Denmark boosts its defence spending, with Russia reasserting itself on the continent and the US questioning the NATO alliance. Are European countries having to learn to stand up for themselves? And speaking of US isolationism, Trump plans to drag the states out of UNESCO. We'll ask why and what it means for the organisation. And finally, Beijing is ramping up for the 19th National Congress of the Communist Party next week. The party says it wants to be more transparent, but does it really? That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Chris Lord. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Somnath Batabayel, lecturer in media and development and international journalism at SOAS here in London, and Jonathan Fenby, former editor of the South China Morning Post and now chairman of China Research and director of European Political Research at TS Lombard. Welcome both of you to the programme. We're going to start in Turkey, where a reporter for the Wall Street Journal has been sentenced to 2 years and 1 month in prison. Ayla Albayrak, who was thankfully in New York when the sentence was passed, is accused of spreading terrorist propaganda through one of her articles. Now, attacks on the press have become rather commonplace in Turkey. It's ranked as one of the world's worst jailers of journalists by the Committee to Protect Journalists. Jonathan, maybe we could start with you here. Look, we've seen, you know, increasingly ramped up pressure on the press at home in Turkey. We've seen, you know, local organisations be shut down, local journalists jailed. What seems to be happening now is Erdogan and his crew are looking towards the international press a lot more. They're not afraid anymore to jail foreign, or to, in this case, sentence, even in absentia, foreign journalists to this crime of terrorism and so on. Is this a change of pace, do you think? Is this a game changer?
It's a change of pace. It's a logical change of pace, I'd say. What you say is certainly true. And indeed, you know, the authorities in Turkey may even feel that they have a certain benefit to draw from targeting foreign journalists who they can link with, say, you know, opposition, the Gulenists, and so on, in the United States. You can see this conspiracy theory growing, and I know to some extent from my own experience, journalists are very easily caught up in this because, you know, you write accurate reporting, but obviously, governments at any point can say, ah, well, actually, you're working subversively for our opponents. And particularly in this case, where you've had, 50,000 people or so or more detained in Turkey since the coup attempt last year. Obviously, this kind of, I think, fits into the narrative pretty well.
Somnath, what do you think the government is trying to achieve there in Turkey? I mean, you know, as Jonathan's saying there, it fits into this narrative of jailing people who they believe to be involved in the coup or accused of coup plotting and so on. When you start jailing foreign journalists, I mean, it can't end well, can it? What is it they possibly want to achieve here, do you think?
One of the first things they're easily doing is they don't have to jail this particular journalist. She is in outside, right? It sends a very clear, strong message to journalists about how they should perform in Turkey. There's a process of self-editorialization which might just set in because no one wants to be accused of, as Ayla has been. But just to put in a larger perspective, Reporters Without Borders have been carrying out their annual reports and they have found that in most countries across the world, including, you know, countries like the US and the UK, there's a sense of nationalization and the press and journalists have been caught up. Trump has led very direct assaults and you know, arguments against the press in public. Even in the UK, you know, a minister goes on record on BBC saying journalists should be more patriotic. So there's this sense of...
But you're saying there's a mood of journalists should be clipped, is what you're saying.
Look at what's happening in India. Look at what's happening in Pakistan. It's a sort of larger international trend of attacks on journalists.
Jonathan, when you think about the Journal, though, I mean, yeah, if we look at some of the Journal's reporting in the last few years on Turkey, it's been excellent. I mean, they've done some fascinating reports on the state of education there and so on. But it is fundamentally a markets newspaper. It's like the Financial Times here in the UK. It's a paper that's there to talk about business. And doesn't it seem for a country like Turkey that puts such emphasis on its business, a little bit counterintuitive here?
Well, Erdogan's understanding of economics often passes all understanding, it must be said. He has a particular view of that, particularly, you know, of interest rates or the market as such. I think, you know, the Journal, like the FT, has been very successful at broadening out from the essentially finance coverage into much wider coverage. And that's actually given it quite a lot of strength and so on. But I doubt very much whether Erdogan and those around him would think, well, we're going to have a negative mark against us among readers of the Wall Street Journal on Wall Street, let us say, if we take action against one of the reporters. I don't think it works like that. And the other thing is that I'd say again, from my own experience, that governments very often seem to think, well, they can easily pick off journalists, they can do this or they can do that against journalists. And while, of course, journalists are very important and think of themselves as carrying out an important trade or whatever it is, profession and so on, for governments that often doesn't count as much as it should, or one would like it to think it did.
If you look at the actual content of this article that's caused this case, we have to remember this case has been going on for 2 years and it's only now the sentence has actually been handed out. Yeah. If you look at that article, I mean, that was Ayla reporting from the southeast of Turkey when Turkey really sort of embarked on this extraordinary, it was a kind of quasi-civil war at that time, if you remember. You know, there were bombardments of Diyarbakir and all these major cities down in the southeast. If you look at that article, I mean, it's pretty benign stuff here. Yeah. I wondered when I read this story, do you think, Somnath, this is for yourself, do you think this was in some way timed to what we've been seeing over the border in Iraq with regards to the referendum there? Do you think this is a sort of strong message to say, if you try and tell stories about our misdeeds in the southeast, let's say, for want of a better phrase, there's going to be consequences, we're not going to have anything like a breakaway state in our southeast?
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't have put it any better, yes. I don't know how to kind of elaborate on that. You've explained it so well. Absolutely. It just sends out a clear message, not only to Ireland and Wall Street Journal, but to journalists within Turkey and those coming into Turkey, you know, that there is a certain editorial line which needs to be pursued. If not, there will be consequences, as you say.
On the idea, just coming back to what you were talking about before, about what governments want from journalists, Jonathan, I mean, we've seen the soft power of Turkey take this phenomenal nosedive in the last few years. Yeah. I mean, if you think just a decade ago, you know, how different the situation was. And it's obviously been picked over at length. But I wonder, you know, is there any, do you think there's any interest now amongst Erdogan and the government there to restitute those relations with the West, with America? I mean, we've seen the US kind of impose a semi-travel ban in the last few weeks. Yeah. Is there any interest, or do you think really it's gone too far and now the government of Turkey is saying, well, you know what, we've been investing into schools in Somalia, we've been putting money into the Middle East, we host in Syrian refugees, our world is no longer the West?
I think that's very much the case, that you get a point where indeed the whole thing turns on its head because the kind of good relationship with the West, in this case, and with the Western media, which you were talking about, at some point you turn that on its head, and actually having bad relations with the West and its media is seen as a sign of strength for the strong men. I mean, this is a classic thing, you know, the world is against me, I'm standing up to the world, and in a very small part of the forest, I'm going to take action against this journalist, and that can then be played internally by regimes like that in Turkey to the public, which probably has never heard of the Wall Street Journal and couldn't care less, but the reporter, she can be depicted as, here's a foreign subversive agent who was working with the Kurds against the interests of Turkey, and your government has taken resolute action against her, although she works for a newspaper in this great superpower, the United States. So, you know, that kind of narrative, to go back to that phrase, can be built up. Mm. And we've seen this, you know, over the centuries, I think.
Somnath, just very, very briefly before we move on, I just want to ask you, where do you think Turkey's going to go now with this? Because, you know, we've seen in absentia, you know, this conviction here, this sentence being handed out, obviously, unless Ayla comes back to Turkey, which I imagine she's not going to do, it's not really going to have that much effect. But do you think it's going to see a broader gutting of the international press in Turkey in the next few weeks?
Well, it doesn't have any further to go down. It's ranked 155th in press freedom.
True, yeah, exactly.
Just, you know, beyond, just before Pakistan
and
Russia.
But we still do see government, you know, we still do see organisations invested in bureaus there, in having reports. Do you think that's going to change?
It's an important country. You know, its geographical position makes it important. It's politically important. So therefore, yes, we will try and get stories out of there. We'll try and send journalists in there. But as I said, you know, Turkey couldn't be in a worse position in its treatment to journalists. It's got the most number of journalists arrested internationally. Mm. So, you know, it has sent out its message. It's for the West and the East to react to it.
Mm, absolutely. Well, we'll put Turkey on ice just for a moment now and talk about Denmark. So Denmark's planning the biggest hike in military spending since the end of the Cold War. It wants a 20% boost to its defence budget over the next 5 years, as the country hopes to implement its own air defence programme and sonars to detect submarines in its waters. Somnath, just give me a sense here. How much do you think this decision is inspired by what we've seen coming out of the White House? You know, since even when Trump was on the campaign trail, he was talking about, you know, whether NATO is going to have any importance in the future. He's come to power, and obviously that hasn't quite worked out as he initially said it to be. But do you think the Danes are thinking that, you know, we do need to do this for ourselves more? It's not going to have that same assurances from America, do you think?
Well, I think the pressures are from larger pressures. NATO has already been talking about that Denmark needs to carry its, you know, its relevance, its military relevance. Sweden and Norway have stepped up their budget spending on defence in the last couple of years. Mm. And if you look at in a larger context, you know, since the 1990s, Denmark has been cutting budget spending. In 2015, I think it stood about 1.2% of the GDP. So this 20% increase in a larger scheme of things, and in seeing countries, European countries and America, it's not that huge. And it had to do it to satisfy NATO's demands. And also, if you look at Russia and what Russia has done towards Eastern Europe in its recent military advances. So it was fairly logical for Denmark. And Denmark, since 2008, you know, since the financial crash, has a right-wing conservative government. Its public spending has been very limited. So in that context, I don't think the spending is huge, but it's taking definite steps to allay NATO fears.
Jonathan, what do you think Denmark's worried about here? Because, you know, if you look at where it's positioned there, I mean, yeah, okay, we've got the Baltic states, we've seen Sweden reintroduce conscription, we've seen it put troops back on Gotland, you know, across Estonia, there's been this huge deployment of NATO, or relatively large deployment of NATO troops in the last year. What do you think Denmark is concerned about? I mean, is it Russian fear? Do you think it's concerned about?
I think it probably is Russian fear. It's a general Russian fear. But as we were just hearing, I mean, there's also, I think, more of a recognition now among NATO members in Europe that, yes, I mean, I don't want to use the Trump word, but they have been freeloading for a long time on the United States. And according to data I saw there, in fact, this increase will only increase the defence spending as a percentage of GDP to 1.3% from 1.2%. And that's still quite a long way off the 2% floor, which is meant to be there for Europe's NATO members. So we're a long way from that. Indeed.
Do you think it's a case of trying to keep Trump a bit happier?
And it may be. Well, keeping Trump happier, whether it's directly keeping Trump happier, but it's perhaps showing I am a good NATO member and we're doing our best and so on and so on. I mean, don't want to minimise it in any way, but because there is quite a lot of money involved here, 500 million and so on. But even that, in terms of military budgets today, is not that big. And the difficulty with this whole NATO spending thing is that the West Europeans and the European members of NATO have fallen progressively behind for so long that in order actually to catch up to the 2%, which is meant to be the minimum or more, that would mean, you know, a new round of extra austerity on social services, welfare, education, health, and everything else, which nobody is going to accept electorally in Europe. So I don't want to minimise this, but in a sense, I think this is we're playing gesture politics here quite largely.
That's interesting. I mean, that idea of it as a gesture is interesting because, I mean, you're right, it's not a massive jump in terms of certainly in percentage of GDP and so on. But Somnath, I mean, in the last few weeks, we've seen, you know, Russia make very, very strong statements on the idea if Sweden was to join NATO, the consequences would be huge and so on. If this is gesture politics, can we expect Russia to react, do you think, when Denmark says it's going to bump things up by 20% in terms of military spending?
I mean, I'm always scared to say, yes, Russia might react. You never know how they will react. But I think Russia will definitely take note of it. And NATO members want Russia to take note of it. Mm-hmm. Given what happened in Eastern Europe with Russia, and NATO's complete inability to react to that moment, NATO members do want Russia to know. I mean, that's why Sweden, which is non-aligned, has bumped up its defense spending considerably. So has Norway. Mm. Finland remains in the still in the old school. So I think, yes, Russia will take note. Hopefully, Russia will not react because it's, as we say, it's gesture politics. It's 1.2 to 1.3. So it doesn't really mean, in that sense, a huge tactical realignment needs to be done. But it's intended for Russia to take note. It's intended also for America to take note. It's a post-Cold War politics coming up again.
It is. Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's gesture politics at its finest, I guess. Well, you're listening to Midori House here with me, Chris Lord, Somnath Battabiyal and Jonathan Fenby. We're going to take a very short break now, but coming up next, press freedom at China's Communist Party Congress, which kicks off next week, and the US is going to quit UNESCO. Stay tuned.
For Monocle's retail-themed October issue, our editors turn their gaze to the plucky shopkeepers and business folk, looking beyond the dire headlines and still turning a profit by keeping our high streets lively. We meet the people behind a wise weekend market venture in Frome in the UK, the retailers rebuilding Italy's Porto Cervo and touting their wares in Taichung. Not to mention a retail survey brimming with bright ideas in bricks and mortar. We also see how cities can kickstart their own revival, from Detroit to Yangon. Peek into the studio of artist Gary Hume and ogle the enviable new digs of an architecture practice who took over a dilapidated department store in South London. All before our selection of the 25 smartest sartorial finds from the world of fashion. All this and much more besides can be found in Monocle's October issue, which is out now and available from all good newsstands.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the programme delivers definitive insights into the people, places and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1600 London time. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. I'm Chris Lord. Still with me are Somnath Battabiyal, lecturer in media and development at SOAS here in London, and Jonathan Fenby, former editor of the South China Morning Post and now chairman of China Research and the director of European Political Research at TS Lombard. Now we're going to look to China. Next week, Beijing will host the 19th National Congress of the Communist Party of China. The event, held every 5 years, sets the agenda for the country and the party over the next half decade. The Straits Times of Singapore reports that this year, for the first time, a special delegates' passage will be set up in the Great Hall of the People, giving Chinese and foreign journalists a chance to interview the party delegates attending the meet. Jonathan, let's start with you. Now, this is obviously an attempt to boost transparency or perhaps the image of transparency, but The Guardian reports that a leaked censorship directive instructed all media outlets to publish nothing but stories from the official news agency, Xinhua. So is this just transparency theatre, do you think?
Yes, I mean, this is transparency theatre. You know, even if it was one was able, the journalists, to ask questions as freely as, you know, has been implied, what would be the replies? I mean, no delegate at the party congress is going to say, well, actually, I think Xi Jinping should be doing that or should be doing that, etc. You know, we've had in the last weeks a series of adulation of Xi Jinping statements. There's a six-part series on television, I think, about how he's now, you know, the great master of diplomacy, who has overturned 300 years of Western-style diplomacy in favour of something new. This Congress is Xi Jinping's power fest. After 5 years in power, he's celebrating, really, you know, his authority, the concentration of power. And that's what it's about. And certainly no journalists, and particularly not foreign journalists, are going to be allowed to interfere with that.
Jonathan, just staying with you. I mean, how you've obviously reported on many of these congresses in the past.
Yeah.
Just give everybody a sense of what it's like to report on something like this. How orchestrated is it? How much access do you usually get? And when you hear stuff like that, do you think, oh, well, this is obviously a little bit more access or not at all?
Well, it's a kind of access, but, you know, what the access is worth is the question there. The meeting is held in the Great Hall of the People in Beijing. It's an enormous amphitheater there. And you get the General Secretary, that's Xi Jinping, the head of the Communist Party, delivering a lengthy report. It usually has about 15 different part sections to it on how, really designed to say how the Communist Party is essential to China and how its rule must continue forever, and now as personified by its leader Xi Jinping to a greater extent than was the case with his predecessors. And then you get the only real moment of suspense, which is at the end of the Congress, when the members of the Standing Committee of the Communist Party Politburo, there are seven of them at the moment, that may be cut down this time, it's not quite sure, but they file out of the Great Hall of the People into a kind of public amphitheatre, and this is televised, and they walk out in the order in which they've been placed in the rankings in the Standing Committee, and you see, he's ahead of him, da-da-da-da. So that's the moment, it's like a beauty contest almost, you get them, and the most interesting event was at the Congress before last, when there was some uncertainty as to whether Xi Jinping would be nominated in effect as the successor to Hu Jintao, then the party leader, or whether Li Keqiang, who was Hu Jintao's own protege, would be the man. And so we all waited, and Xi walked out one place ahead of Li, so he's going to be the leader in 10 years' time. You know, this is long-term politics.
When we hear that, I mean, you know, the way Jonathan described it, I mean, it is the most theatrical thing we can imagine. I mean, right down to the order of which people come out of the whole thing. You know, in terms of actually reporting and being there, what do you think is the value of the foreign press going there and reporting a story like that? I mean, in a sense, you know, they're not going to get anything beyond what Xinhua has to say. I mean, they may as well use these agency reports as it's saying. What do you think?
Well, brilliant colour stories, as Jonathan was just telling you of the Great Hall. You know, so in one sense, that's right, that you will not have access to the top bureaucrats, the top officials. And even if you have a few of them coming in, their answers will be carefully orchestrated. But it's very definite that the General Secretary at this point of time in 2017... the leader of the second most affluent nation in the world, the largest populated, it's a black box. You don't know how the leader is elected. You've no clue. So there had to be a sense of some sort of change. And again, as Jonathan was correctly mentioning, this is the General Secretary's great big, you know, confident dance at the moment. There is conversation about who will be his successor or whether there'll be an unprecedented third term. But also there are slightly more disturbing trends of how he overhauls the world's largest military. Will there be work on the 33 million a trillion ton of debt, you know, which is waiting. So all these interesting moments are there. The press is invited in for a definitely a very censored version of it, but it's an interesting Congress to happen, and you know the world will be watching.
Jonathan, how much holding to account will be there? I mean, some math is right. I mean, he's talking about, you know, China in, you know, embroiled in lots and lots of debt, problems that it faces right now. These Congresses, I mean, are they sort of an opportunity to kind of wheel everybody out and say, look how great things are, of course this has to last forever, or does anybody ever get held to account at these things?
No, people don't get held to account. Very occasionally at the National People's Congress, which is the legislature that meets only once a year, imagine Parliament meeting once a year, in March, occasionally there are a few people who abstain from voting confidence in the government on particularly on sensitive issues. There was on the Three Gorges Dam, there was a little mini revolt many years ago, and so on. But no, I mean, this is black box politics. It is decided now even more so than in the past within the top elite of the Communist Party, within the leading groups, within committees chaired by Xi Jinping. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to be frank, you read the runes and you say, you think, what is going to happen? That's what I do a lot of the time. And you hope you're right. But for the confirmation, I mean, the thing at this Congress in terms of personalities is whether Wang Qishan, who has run the anti-corruption campaign in China, is the second most powerful man in China, more powerful than the Prime Minister, but who should retire because he's past the age limit, but the age limit isn't written down anywhere. And if he steps out among the seven people who come out of the Great Hall, then that will be the headline news. If he doesn't step out, that will be the headline news. But we're really, you know, you're waiting for that for that moment. I can only say at the last Congress, not to go on for too long, I was invited on Chinese television to, as they put it, commentate on the leadership when they came out. It was as if it was a horse race and so on. But they were 45 minutes late coming out and the programme was live. So we had to blather on for 45 minutes filling in for them. That was my main memory of the last Congress.
So heavily orchestrated, but also not without its hitches either, I guess.
Yeah. Not without its hitches. And, you know, it is important because you have to accept that is the way, for good or ill, and I think for ill, that's the way the Chinese system works. And you have to try to understand how it works and what it means. And in the weeks after the Congress, there will be all kinds of speculation, some of it well-founded, some of it not, as we try to look ahead for the next 5 years.
So that's the Congress next week. We'll be all over it, I guess, here on Monocle 24. Now, finally, on today's Midori House, the US is planning to pull out of the UN's cultural organisation, UNESCO, accusing it of anti-Israel bias. It's the second time the US has jumped the UNESCO ship. The first time was in 1984, when the Reagan administration accused the agency of an ideological bias towards the Soviet Union. It did, however, of course, rejoin in 2002 under George Bush. Somnath, let's start with you. I mean, this anti-Israel bias, I mean, it's a pretty strong accusation. Does it stick, do you think?
I don't know if it sticks, but if the US says it, then it sticks. And the US and Israel both have accused UNESCO of this. But, you know, one of the clear statements from the current director general is that the politicization of the body has really harmed UNESCO's, you know, the way it works, the way it functions, its reputation. Mm. So that's clear. And, you know, having recently declared Hebron a World Heritage Site, that has irked Israel very much. Recognizing Palestine has irked. Now, the question will be, does UNESCO need to do this? Or does it have a clear mandate to do this? Or does it have a different kind of purpose? That's the question. But U.S. walking out, U.S. has not been paying into its kitty for a long time. The finances are in a mess.
And there is some speculation that this is a cash, you know, cost-saving method as well, isn't it?
Well, really? They've not been paying since 2011, if I remember correctly. It's bad news for UNESCO. And without U.S. being the most powerful country in the world, you know, when you're not in an organization like the UN, it really diminishes its stature. Mm. So not good news.
Jonathan, we've got a couple of minutes left really on the show, but I just want to ask you briefly, you know, do you think, I mean, we've seen, you know, throughout this show, we talked about, you know, NATO potentially, you know, Trump questioning the future of NATO and so on, now pulling out of UNESCO. Is this, I mean, is this isolationism? Is it, can we actually call it that? Is UNESCO really a sort of bastion of internationalism and of multilateralism and so on that it really stands to be? Is it that important, do you think?
No, I don't think it is. It's UNESCO, you know, the trouble is that people think UNESCO should be a purely cultural, educational, above politics and so on. Mm. But inevitably, politics get involved and it becomes a political organisation. And when you have a majority of states which are critical and are going to attack Israel, they can use it for that because they will have a majority. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the reality, I think. And if you should say that UNESCO should not be dealing with any political matters, well, it makes it more or less, it might as well fold up and go home, I would think, because everything has become politicised these days. And that's the process that it's found itself in. I was involved in a whole big debate about the World Information Order in the 1970s and 80s, and it was just impossible because you met ministers from countries like Turkey who would preach on about the freedom of the press and how we terrible Western journalists perverted information and so on and so on. And if you dared to say, well, you've locked up 200 journalists recently, they'd say, that's fake news.
That's very interesting. Very interesting indeed. I mean, I'm curious, just coming back to you for a second. I mean, you know, the US did help found this organisation in the aftermath of World War II. Yeah. Does this kind of complicate its legacy a little bit here? I mean, we even write back to the various organisations that were set up in the aftermath of World War II. Here's another one that it's pulling out of. I mean, is this a sort of statement, do you think, that these organisations simply don't work anymore, these multilateral organisations like this?
Well, I mean, loads of questions are being asked of large organisations like the UN, which is the largest bureaucracy in the world. Mm. But and Jonathan mentioned the NUICO debates. You know, the complexities in the UN has always carried on from its earliest days, and it'll always be there. And it cannot be a depoliticized organization. I don't think the US quitting helps the UN reputation and organizations within the UN's reputation at all. So that is a problem. And it took them about 20 years the last time to come back. We hope this time it'll be, you know, a quicker one. But yeah, it cannot be deep. I agree with Jonathan on and someday I would love to talk to you more about the NUICO debate.
Well, that'll take me back to I had more hair in those days.
Well, that does bring us to the end of Midori House. Thank you very much for joining us here on Monocle 24. Somnath Battabayal, lecturer in media and development at SOAS, and Jonathan Fenby, former editor of the South China Morning Post and now director of European Political Research at TS Lombard. Thank you both of us. Today's show was produced by Henry Reese Sheridan, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Katie Watkins. Our studio manager was David Stevens. More music coming up. Then at 1900 hours, it's going to be The Urbanist, and we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Stay tuned for that. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. I'm Chris Lord. Thanks for listening and goodbye.